Welcome to the Food Bullying Podcast.
That's Michelle Payne. She wrote the book on food bullying.
And that's Eliz Green. She is all about keeping stress under control.
And we both love to eat and talk about food. So let's just dive in. Michelle, I know in your book, Food Bullying, you talked about when we are most vulnerable to that sort of thing. What do you think about that?
I think it's interesting when you take a look at the changes that we have in life, whether it's a college student moving out and having to feed themselves for the first time, or whether it's at the other end of the spectrum where perhaps someone's moving into a senior citizen center, or perhaps it's when you become pregnant. There's so many different phases in life that can leave you vulnerable, or illness or so forth. And one of the stories that really caught my attention when I was writing the book was from a young farm mom who actually was the mom of a son. And she went to her doctor's office when she was pregnant, and she wanted to ask the question about what was going on with the pregnancy. And the doctor asked her if she wanted to abort her son because he had a cleft palate. And then the office proceeded to tell her that it was because she lived on a farm that her son had a cleft palate and supposedly access to chemicals. Now, we all know that's not true, but can you imagine? I think about when you were pregnant, how would you have felt if a medical professional had said that to you? And clearly, pregnancy is one of those times when we are most vulnerable. I'm thrilled to report the young man is now a 9-year-old 4-H'er. He loves to show his cattle. He's out on the farm all the time. And as this mom shared, she was pretty upset because the medical professionals assumed that it was agriculture's fault, and it clearly was not. It was the way her son was created. So just really want people to step back and think about when you're the most vulnerable to bullying. And it's likely during life's most significant changes and challenges. And I happen to be friends with Heather, that's our guest today. She also grows one of my very favorite products in the world, sweet potatoes. But I've watched Heather journey through some huge challenges, health challenges with her sons, which I'll let her share. But I'm super excited for the message that she's going to bring today. And I think it's one that every parent needs to hear. You're doing okay is the big message, in my opinion.
Well, let's introduce our guest. Heather Barnes grew up in town and didn't know anything about farming other than how to identify cotton and peanuts before going to college. She began a career in agriculture after graduating from Virginia Tech with an animal science degree. Heather has worked with many types of farms throughout her career as an extension agent and now a marketing specialist. She is married to a second-generation farmer. They grow sweet potatoes, tobacco, corn, soybeans, and wheat. She's also a mother to 3 sons, ages 7, 4, and 1, which means she's very busy. Their oldest son was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder 4 years ago, and their middle son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes almost a year ago. Heather, welcome to the Food Bullying Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I can't imagine what it was like to have a child diagnosed with diabetes so early. And I know, as Michelle mentioned, with the vulnerability, that opened up some food bullying. Can you tell us about that?
It was terrifying. Our son had just turned 3, and we started noticing some frequent urination. He was thirsty all the time, always wanted water. And we expressed our concerns and were told just to keep an eye on him. I mean, he was still himself. He still wanted to play. But as, you know, we started noticing it right around his birthday, right around Christmas. And as January came into play, it started getting worse. And then we started noticing he didn't have a lot of energy. And then there came a point where his preschool sent a picture and he's laying in the floor while all his friends are playing around him. And, you know, that's not a 3-year-old behavior. So we called the doctor, we took him in, and he was in DKA, which is diabetic ketoacidosis.
Oh dear.
Where his body was not being able to utilize the food he ate to create energy. So it was taking from his fat cells to create energy, which then, you know, gets that situation where his body becomes acid and you get ketones. It's a life or death situation at that point. And I just remember driving him to the ER glancing in the back. He's slumped over in his car seat, and I'm terrified he's passed out. And I'm calling his name, trying to get him to look at me, you know, on that drive to the ER, you know, parking, running him into the ER. And it's terrifying because it's your child.
Yeah.
And then getting that diagnosis, which for us really came out of left field. I have one cousin that has diabetes. We don't have a strong family history of it. And I always had heard that, you know, you needed a family history of diabetes. So getting that diagnosis, he spent 2 days in pediatric ICU to get where they started giving him insulin and getting his blood sugar regulated, getting the ketones flushed out. And then we spent another day in the hospital just learning about type 1 diabetes and how to manage it and you know, what our new normal was going to be. So it's scary. It's overwhelming. it's a lot of emotions. I mean, I can remember sitting in the hospital bed to give him the first shot I gave him of insulin. And I was just sobbing because now I'm going to have to give my child injections. And this is his new normal for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Well, and insulin, as you said, is a part of his daily life now, which is great that there's something that can be done so your son can be healthy, but that created some problems as well, right?
Well, you know, I didn't know a lot about diabetes, and I found out, you know, once we got type 1, what I knew really wasn't right. You know, insulin, you know, we all depend on insulin. It's a hormone that is produced in our pancreas to control our blood sugar levels. And with type 1 diabetics, it's actually an autoimmune reaction where the body attacks the cells that produce insulin. So your body produces little to no insulin. And there's no prevention, there's no cure. They don't know what triggered it to happen, you know, when he turned 3. There's only management, and that's where insulin comes into play. And when he was first diagnosed on a hurricane, we're going to get insulin. I was like, okay, I know about insulin. It's made from pig pancreas. But I was really surprised when I started looking it up that it's a GMO. It was the first genetically modified organism that was approved by the FDA and has been used for over 40 years. And I wasn't expecting that.
It's an amazing story, isn't it, when you look at the consistency of what's available to your son now. So what did you learn about GMO insulin as compared to what you had known as insulin from pigs?
Well, as I was reading about it, you know, before insulin was even discovered, diabetes was a death sentence. I mean, the patients, basically starved to death because their bodies couldn't use the energy from the food they were eating. So insulin was discovered back in the 1920s, and that really changed a diabetes diagnosis from a fatal disease to a chronic condition that we can manage. So they used pig and beef pancreas, which at that time was a waste product of the meatpacking industry. And they were able to extract insulin from the pig or beef pancreas to make an insulin product humans could use. And I was reading some of the history of that discovery, and it took over 2 tons of pig parts just to make 8 ounces of purified insulin.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, wow. So that discovery really revolutionized people with diabetes. It changed their life. But the body still knows that it's foreign because it is from pig and beef. So some people did have immune reactions to it, making that insulin less effective. And then, you know, in the early 1970s, the supply of animal pancreas started decreasing. And at the same time, the number of people diagnosed with diabetes was increasing. So there was this concern that there would be a possible shortage of insulin in the future. And so research started happening. And it was really, you know, insulin was really the birth of biotechnology. Insulin was the first recombinant DNA drug produced in the world that was approved by the FDA, and it was approved in 1982. So we've been using this insulin since the 1980s. And it's really, you know, it's identical to what his body would make. They've been able tweak how it works. So now we have, you know, some insulin. My son takes a long-acting insulin once a day that stays in his body for 24 hours. He also gets a short-acting one, you know, whenever he eats, that helps convert those carbs in the food he just ate. And that's because of this technology. It's given people with diabetes greater options for how to manage their blood sugar. So compared to what I was reading, you know, back when they were using animal insulin and people were having to use, you know, they didn't have disposable syringes then and you only had the one type of insulin. So they were, you know, administering the insulin was a painful process, but it was a good trade-off at the time. So that biotechnology has made a huge difference, you know, not just in our life, but for anyone that has diabetes.
Well, and my understanding is that the better you can control the blood sugar levels, the healthier the person is in the long run, that there's damage when it goes out of whack either direction, there's damage that happens. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, and that's one of the things we've learned about diabetes is it's you can manage it. I mean, you're managing it 24/7, but you still have highs, you still have lows. Different thing, you know, if he goes outside and plays and it's really hot, that affects his blood sugar. There are certain foods that it may rise quicker than, it, you know, other foods he eats. If he's sick, I mean, just a common cold. He had a cold about a month ago and he started producing ketones again. So I'm on the phone with the doctor every day for 5 days trying to get them flushed out of him. Because, you know, that fear comes back that, oh, God, we've been in the hospital twice. I don't want to go for round three. But there are long-term effects, you know, if it's not managed properly, you know, they check his vision, loss of eyesight, you know, loss of limbs because it affects blood circulation. And one thing we learned too is because type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disorder, that then makes him vulnerable to other autoimmune disorders. So when he was diagnosed, they automatically checked his thyroid and they will continue to do that every year. And they automatically checked for celiac disease, which I didn't realize either that was an autoimmune disorder. So there can be long-term negative effects, you know, if it's not managed.
Sure. So it sounds like the GMO insulin has been really a godsend for people with diabetes. What's the other side? What have you experienced with people that are fearful of GMOs?
You know, we see it in ag because we farm. And so I hear, you know, people that are anti-GMO because of in the agricultural world, you know, there's 10 commercially available crops that are GMO. And there is a movement against that. But those crops have really given farmers greater tools, you know, decreasing pesticides. Now we've got the new Arctic apple, which is anti-browning. So it's going to cut down on food waste, which is a beautiful thing. And I was really, and I don't know why I was surprised, because I know about the anti-GMO movement in agriculture that, you know, we went back when this insulin was being developed, there were protests against it. And there were a lot of regulations put in place and a lot of restrictions put on the researchers by people who didn't support the science of it. And to me, as a mom whose son's life depends on insulin, knowing that there is an unlimited supply now, knowing that it's what he would, you know, as close to as what he would, his body would naturally produce. There's not that risk of having a reaction. I can't imagine not having that there, because we're talking about my child's life and this is literally saving his life.
I think it's amazing and sad at the same time, because I've talked with other parents who actually have been bullied because they're using GMOs to treat their children. And it's so extensive that one mom I know of actually doesn't give her child as much insulin as they need because it's genetically modified, and other parents have told her she shouldn't be doing that. What's your reaction as the mom of a very young diabetic who's clearly, I mean, this has left you very vulnerable, I'm sure, and Did you ever consider changing your stance on GMOs, or do you feel as though you've been targeted in your vulnerability and tried to care for him?
I've not experienced that where people have said, hey, you know, you shouldn't give insulin, it's a GMO. But I can see easily, unfortunately, easily how that could happen, because you're a parent, your child, you know, this is a life or death situation your child is in. And that fear is what these anti-movements play to. They take that fear and they make it even greater. And it just makes me so angry for this mom who is already struggling, who's already scared, who is already, you know, even some days now, we've been in this journey for a year, and there are some days I don't even know how to manage this, that I'm still calling the doctor. I don't know what to do. So you're so vulnerable. And then to have somebody take advantage of that because of how they feel about something, it's just wrong. I mean, as a mom, my child's life is the most important thing. And if there is this medication out there that will save his life, I'm making that choice, because I have to make the choice that's best for my child, our family. And I'm not taking anybody else's opinion into account that doesn't agree with it, especially if they're not, you know, they're not a professional. You know, that's one thing. When he was diagnosed, we became a part of this whole new community. You know, now we have endocrinologists, and I've talked to registered dietitians, and I've talked to other parents. So we have this whole community that we're surrounding ourselves with. And, you know, this medicine is saving our son's life, not giving it to him because it's a genetically, you know, modified organism. It's not an option. And as I read more about this, I learned how many other medicines, you know, use this same technology. Treatments for sickle cell anemia, treatments for cancer, treatments for cystic fibrosis. That's advancements that have allowed people to live longer and to live better lives.
As kids go to school, and do things like sports camps and things like that, there's always an opportunity. I think that's another vulnerability to where food bullying can happen, when other people are looking at what kids are eating or doing and perhaps making some sort of judgment. How do you advocate for your son, and how are you preparing him to advocate for himself?
When he was first diagnosed, we went to class. We, as his parents, the grandparents came, his sitters came, so we could learn more about diabetes, more learn how to manage it. And then the registered dietitian also came to his preschool and did a class for all of his teachers, which was fantastic, and really talked about what type 1 diabetes is, how to manage it, how to give his insulin, how to figure up how much insulin he needs. So that's very helpful, because not everybody's comfortable doing that. Not everybody's comfortable giving him a shot. And I can understand that. I mean, I wasn't either at first, but I just have to keep telling myself I'm saving his life with every shot. And that really helped me get past that hurdle of I'm giving my child a shot. And so one of the things I thought about diabetes was they couldn't have sweets. And that's not the case. They can still have sweets. It just becomes more of a treat and less of an everyday thing. Or, you know, instead of a full Reese cup, he gets a mini Reese cup. And so we've had to adjust things at snack time. For a while there, we were having to send a different snack because he needed to eat, but he didn't. He's not a big fan of salty foods. You know, he didn't like some of the things that they had at snack. And then if his blood sugar drops, he has to have juice. He has to have something to get it back up. And that happened at school. And then, you know, the kids are asking, you know, well, why does he get juice? Why does he get this snack now when they weren't? So they're noticing, you know, there are times, you know, we were at sports camp last summer and his blood sugar dropped and I had to pull him out and go sit on the bleachers and give him the emergency juice, which is just regular juice, because it brings his blood sugar back up quickly. And again, that goes back to that management. You're managing it 24/7, and, you know, different things can affect it. He could eat the same thing every day, and one day his blood sugar is fine, and one day it might go low or go high. So just talking about, you know, to people that he's around about what diabetes is, what it looks like for him, and then empowering him. I mean, yes, he just turned four, but he can lay everything out that he needs when it's time to get his shot. If we have to prick his finger to check his blood, he can put all of that out. He knows to check his, he has a continuous glucose monitor, which is on his body. It reads his blood sugar all the time. And it, my four-year-old has a cell phone because it reads to his cell phone. And then that connects to our phone. So I can sit here right now. He's at preschool an hour away. I'm in my office and I can tell you what his blood sugar is because it's sending it to my phone. He can look at it and tell you, you know, oh, my blood sugar is fine, or oh, it's red, I need emergency juice. He asks me now, you know, when we get food out, he's like, well, how many carbs are in it? So he knows, and then teaching him to talk about that to other people, you know, the more he knows, the more he's able to communicate, you know, at preschool, you know, every week they have show and tell with the letter of the week. And when it was letter I, he took his insulin pen because it was an opportunity to talk to his classmates about everybody, you know, needs insulin. Their bodies still make it, his doesn't. And so this is why he needs insulin, because they're seeing that need for a snack if his blood sugar drops, or, you know, after snack, you know, he goes out of the classroom to get his shot. So they're noticing it, and we want him to be empowered to talk about it, because one of my fears is that as he gets older, he'll be bullied for being a type 1 diabetic because it's perceived as different. And I don't want him one day to avoid eating certain foods or really binge on certain foods, or, you know, stop checking his blood sugar or not want to give his insulin shots because he's being bullied. Because I've seen, you know, a lot of information, a lot of accounts of kids being bullied for having type 1 diabetes or for medical conditions.
So what's your advice to listeners whose children are in class with diabetics or have diabetics in their life? What are some things that we can all learn from this to be sure that we're not bullying those who have different health conditions?
Well, I think the first thing is just learning about it, talking about it, and being open about it and learning about it. And then understanding that, you know, this isn't, for him, it's not optional. This is, you know, something he lives with 24/7. He can live a normal life, but there are times where he's got to step back and have that extra juice or get that shot because he ate meals. So taking an interest in it, you know, if you're a parent and there's a child, in your child's classroom, you know, learning more about it and then talking openly with your children about it. And as adults, not bullying. You know, you mentioned in the intro that we have an older son with autism. And I was reading the other day a blog from a parent whose son also has autism. And she was talking about how she was having coffee with other parents. And one of the other moms talked about how her child made fun of the autistic kid in their classroom and how hilarious it was. And I'm like, oh my God, this is an adult endorsing bullying. So as adults, we have to take responsibility and recognize that people are different, but that difference, you know, everyone's different. But those differences aren't something, they're something that should be embraced, not something that should be, a child or even an adult should be made to feel less of because of that.
That is so sad. Why do you think bullying is okay in our society?
I think for a lot of it, it's always been that, well, kids are just going to be kids. Oh, it's just kids being kids. And it's one thing, you know, if you call somebody a silly name, and we have this discussion with my older son, my son who has autism, you know, it's one thing if, you know, you call somebody a silly name, but when you're actively targeting them, trying to make them feel less because of a difference, whatever that difference, whether it's a real difference, whether it's a disability, whether it's a perceived difference, that's bullying and that's not okay. And we're seeing more and more awareness of the bullying, but there still seem to be areas where it's and having two children that are special needs, you know, it still seems in some areas that that's okay to bully them. And it's not. And that's something we have to take away, that mindset of it's kids being kids. There's a difference in, you know, just playing around, you know, calling somebody, you know, a silly name versus actively trying to make them feel less because of who they are, what they are, a medical condition. And that's not okay. That's not okay in school. It's not okay at home. It's not anywhere. And it's all of our responsibility to, you know, talk to children and have them understand, you know, that people are different. You know, we have that conversation with kids. I had one not too long ago about, you know, my son has autism. It means he thinks a little differently than we do. And so sometimes we have to talk to him about, you know, social aspects that become natural to you that he doesn't always pick up on. It's really opening ourselves up and learning about things that we don't know anything about. I mean, I really didn't know anything about autism either until it became part of my everyday world.
Well, I think it's an interesting opportunity to bring together the health and agriculture worlds, and you've done a phenomenal job of talking about it. So we didn't get to talk about sweet potato farming very much. So I'm going to ask you in two sentences, what do you wish that people knew about what your family does on the farm?
Oh, gosh. It's on our farm. You know, one thing is that it's a family farm. It's my husband. It's his father. One day, if they choose, it'll be our sons making the decisions out there in the tractor. It's a family farm. Some people might look at it and say, well, you're large, but it's our family. It's our family's farm. We eat the sweet potatoes that we grow on our farm. And so we take the responsibility of growing food and caring for the land very seriously, because food is becoming even more important to us now with this diagnosis. And at the end of the day, you know, it's wonderful that we have choices. We have choices in, as farmers, in what crops we raise, how we grow them. We have choices as consumers that are buying food. And we have choices in, you know, the care of our children. And so even if those are choices that someone disagrees with, we still need to be able to, at the end of the day, respect that we have choice. And I'm thankful for those choices. I'm thankful for the advancements in science that are benefiting our children every day.
Well said. If you had three quick tips for our listeners to overcome food bullying, what would they be?
First is to educate yourself. Talk to professionals. Learn how to read those food labels, because they can be deceiving when you're trying to make food choices for a child or a person with diabetes. Empower yourself and empower your children to advocate for themselves. And then don't let anyone else make choices for you. You are making the best choices for your family, and you know what's best for your family. So whatever choice you make, you are doing great.
Oh, I like that. I think that may be the best takeaway of the day. Whatever you're doing okay. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate all of the information you gave us. Not all of us are dealing with kids with such demanding needs, but I think it is always good to hear from someone who is, because it empowers us to take more control and empower ourselves, as you said, to really make the choices that we need to make and feel good about it. So thank you so much.
Thank you all for having me.
Heather, if people want to get hold of you and connect with you through social media, how can they do so?
I'm on Facebook and Instagram as Carolina Farm Mom. And so I share what's going on in our world, whether and things about autism and diabetes and what's happening on the farm. So they're welcome to find me there.
Excellent. Well, we thank you for coming on to the podcast, and also want to send out a big thanks to our listeners. We hope you found information on this food bullying podcast to build your own food story rather than believing in bull speak. Feel free to leave a comment with questions. Please rate the Food Bullying Podcast if you get a chance. This is Michelle Payne, and I'd love it if you'd understand where your food comes from.
And this is Liz Green. Don't let the stress of about choosing the right food ruin your health.
Remember, food should be about celebration, not condemnation. Cheers.